my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Peddler Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. Bicycle Talk, episode 410, to be broadcast on Wednesday, August 28, 2024, on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch, at least for a little while. If you are watching on Facebook Live, please feel free to comment. We should be able to respond. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show and are listening on Facebook Live, you can comment on the Bicycle Talk Facebook page, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Ron's Rant of the Week. America has poured enough asphalt to build its sprawling auto-centric road network to cover the entire nation of the Netherlands. More on the Netherlands later in the show. I thought that was an interesting statistic. Positive side. Has your city passed the bikeability tipping point? A whopping 183 U.S. cities have built enough bike-friendly streets that their residents just want more of them. Surprise. Is yours one of them? And if not, will it do what it takes to get there? And another thing on my list, the Mansfield Hollow Cyclocross is coming. Damned at the dam. That's what we're calling it this year. It's part of the Project Mayhem Cyclocross series, and it will be the 2024 kickoff race on September 8th. And this Wednesday also begins the CCAP Cyclocross training races in Rocky Hill, Connecticut. If you're thinking of getting your feet wet in cyclocross, give it a try. That's the place to go. You'll find the registration for that at the CCAP website or on BikeRedge. The Vuelta has begun. Oh, yes, it is. So we're nine days into Vuelta now. And it's been crazy. It's been, you know, yet another one of the epic stage races of our time. Good stuff. We'll talk about that more in the show. I'll explain a few things that are going on. It's exciting. Every day is something different. Very, very cool. Mechanical Minute and Ron's Tip of the Week. This, of course, comes from Stage 9 of the Vuelta. Don't try this at home, as Bob Roll said. A little quote there from Bob Roll. Enric Mas avoids a major downhill crash during a morale-boosting Vuelta España attack. So his comment was, I think on TV it looks scarier than it really was because the wind blew me off course, Moss told reporters after Stage 9. But let's review this just for a second, because this was crazy. This is why everybody knows how to ride a bike. Nobody knows how to ride a bike. This guy, though, he knows how to ride a bike. He's going around a corner, and the wind blew, and it blew his rear wheel off, and he started sliding. His rear wheels kicked over to the side, so that he was on a not a good path at all. He was about to go down. In the process of doing that, the bike came up in the air, so the rear wheel came off the ground, and he was riding on the front wheel. Imagine this. He's riding on the front wheel, and of course, if you're in that situation, what do you do, folks? This is Bicycle Recovery 101, we're going to call this. Actually, it's more like 110, but anyway, you clamp the rear brake as quickly as you can, because what it does is it stops the rear wheel from rotating. And when the rear wheel stops rotating, the back end of the bike slams down onto the ground, which is exactly what he did and exactly what happened. and then he skidded the bike off to the side of the road. Fortunately, there was a dirt section where the guardrails had bowed out at that point, like a little turnout, and he was able to skid the bike to a stop. In the process of skidding the bike to the stop, he dropped his chain. Of course, he didn't realize that until he got himself going again down the hill and he started pedaling and he had nothing there. So what does he do? And once again, this is where Bob Roll said, don't try this at home. He reached down and he lifted the chain with his hand and put it up onto the chain ring while riding the bike and continued to pedal on down the hill. Lost about 15 seconds worth of time in the process. Crazy. Crazy, crazy, crazy. You also have to realize he was on a descent, a pretty serious descent with a real sharp corner when this all happened. Just real, real impressive. I'm glad he's in good shape. He's also in very good shape in the Vuelta right now, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on in the show. But crazy, crazy, crazy riding. Good stuff. So that brings us to, how do you put your chain back on the front chain ring without getting off the bike? Because this is something that happens a lot with people. And what you'll find is it's usually because of a poor adjustment or a big gust of wind that kicks your bike up into the air and somehow you're able to get control of your bike and bring it back to normal. Who knows? I don't know. That was definitely weird. But usually it's a malfunction of a chain in the fact that the derailleur maybe not quite right. 9 times out of 10, though, it's rider error. I always focus on the rider error part of this because what usually happens is you're shifting down from the large chain ring to the small chain ring when you shouldn't be, when you should have done it a long time ago, or the other thing is, maybe you did it when you were putting too much pressure on the pedals and you didn't soft pedal to drop the chain down. So anyway, that is a common rider error. And so I see that a lot. And I see it a lot on our group rides, people dropping their chains. And the problem is, if you drop your chain and you're going up a hill, you now have no power whatsoever. And you're going to spin your legs around and then you're going to have to put your foot down or maybe you'll tip over. I've seen people do that too. So how do you put that chain ring, that chain back on the chain ring without getting off your bike? Really simple. Immediately shift the derailleur back up like you're going up into the big chain ring. Okay. While doing that, do not apply a lot of pressure to the pedals. Soft pedal the bike and it should just lift and drop the chain in place. Works 90% of the time. Sometimes it doesn't work and sometimes you just have to pull over. And then I simply do the same thing. I just put the bike up on my neck because I make myself into a human repair stand. And then I do the same activity with a very, very light pressure on the pedals. The key is light pressure on the pedals. If you're jamming hard on the pedals when you do this, you could cause a problem and possible damage to your bike. So I try to warn people about that because especially if you're riding on the new plastic bikes, carbon fiber bikes, you could actually put a pretty good gouge into the carbon as you jam the chain between the chain stay and your chain ring. So you don't want to do that. You want to try to avoid that if you can. If all else fails, you can always just get off the bike, flip it over, and then, you know, try to put it up with your fingers. But now you're going to have little black fingers, and that's why you wear black cycling shorts, by the way, so you can actually wipe off and no one will know. But I would probably encourage you to attempt to put it on the bike first while you're on the bike first, but don't do it the way Ulrich Maas did because that's a good way to lose some fingers. Not a great idea, but he's a pro. That's why he does stuff like that. So anyway, That's my mini tutorial on how to put the chain back up on the bike when it falls off the chain ring, how to put it back in the front chain ring. So, content. The Netherlands. I talked about the Netherlands earlier, right? Because the comment here was that America has poured enough asphalt to cover the entire nation of Netherlands. That's kind of gross as you think about it. That's a whole lot of blacktop, and that is, we are a much larger square acreage, square mileage, whatever you want to call it, nation than the Netherlands is, but still, that's a lot of asphalt. So why is cycling so popular in the Netherlands? Because the Dutch began this obsession in the 1970s in the hopes of moving away from the car-centric approach to safer and more livable cities. Bicycles have since become synonymous with Dutch culture, so here are 9 things that you should know about the Dutch and their wonderful bicycles. I couldn't resist this. I talk about them a lot. And the other thing you should need to know about the Dutch and the Netherlands is they're like rocking the bike racing scene right now, too. A lot of people ride bikes there, and so therefore the popularity has expanded to the racing scene, and so we have, very big bike racing clubs and teams and all coming out of the Netherlands. So it's kind of cool. So 9 things to know about the Dutch. So, like I said, they have an obsession with being on their bikes. And their number one reason is bicycles are a safer alternative to cars. In 1971, the amount of traffic in the Netherlands rose significantly. The roads belong to the cars, not the people. 1970. It's not that long ago, really, when you look at it. And the rate of accidents had increased dramatically. 400 children were killed in that year, with casualties in road accidents reaching a high of 3,300. That's pretty high for a small country. The people in the Netherlands began to protest for bicycle lanes and a safer mode of transport. There were politicians at that time who knew that having too many cars would cause more issues in the future. And after many objections, the politicians in the Netherlands agreed to construct the first of many thousands of bike paths. So that goes all the way back to 1970. They, number two, they can do tricks. The Dutch not only ride their bicycles to work, sport, school, dinners, and nightclubs, they also have some pretty fancy bike skills, from pulling a suitcase behind them with a child on the back seat to lifting their front wheels and riding with their hands in their pockets. The Dutch have mastered the art of cycling. And the person here wrote this, said, I even had a lecturer who used to read his book on the way to classes. Number three, the Dutch have fashioned their bikes to work as cars. From a young age, children are put into crates or barrows attached to their parents' bicycles so the child can sleep whilst the parent pedals. You see many variations of this, where there are 2 different children's seats placed on a bigger, on a bike or a larger barrow, like a wheelbarrow, and it's attached with a cover so that children can sit inside and still stay dry in the rain. This is where the cargo bike idea comes from. It's sort of a front cargo type carrier is what we're looking at. Number four, be aware. The bicycle rules the road. The author here says, I have been nearly knocked over too many times to count, and this is due to my own ignorance. There are 3 key road users in the Netherlands, often with a designated space on the road. There's a space for the cars, a space for the bicycles, and another space for the pedestrians. It's not safe to walk on a bicycle path. The Dutch are fast riders, and they will ding their little bike bells as you are at you as a friendly warning to kindly move out of the cycle track. Take note of your surroundings and look before crossing any road or path. Isn't that great? The bikes have the right of way.
Yeah.
I also read something once that said that if you're in an accident there and it's with a car, that the authorities will immediately assume it's the car's fault, not the cyclist's fault. That's a little different than here in the U.S., isn't it? Okay, number five, always lock your bike. In the Netherlands, people leave their laptop on the train while they go to the bathroom, or leave their front door unlocked whilst they run to the bins around the corner. 9 times out of 10, nothing will happen. But if you leave your bicycle outside unattended without a lock, it will be stolen. Understandably, bicycles are a hot commodity because everyone uses them. So you need to lock your bike. That's a smart thing. Number six, the Dutch are rarely, if ever, seen wearing a helmet. There is no law that forces the Dutch to wear helmets when cycling, and this is because the Cyclist Union in the Netherlands concluded that a helmet for everyday life would prove to have a negative effect on the general health of the population. If you do happen upon someone wearing a helmet, they are most likely a tourist or professional cyclist. So here's the thing. When you take cars out of the picture, you don't need the helmet as much. We have helmets here in the U.S. because we have way too many cars, and way too many cars that are not paying attention and driving too fast. And I'll get to that a little later in the show, because I'm going to beat the dead horse here a little bit on the speed thing. Cycling, number seven, is a way of life. Riding a bike all over the city, to classes, to the shops, out to dinner or to work, is neither considered exercise nor a chore for the Dutch. Cycling is a mode of transport, and the Dutch will often ride their bikes to the gym or to play sports and then ride home. I happen to find cycling to be exercise enough. Well, maybe. Anyway, cars versus bicycles, number eight. Inevitably, there are accidents, but Dutch law protects cyclists, ensuring that motorist insurance must cover at least 50% of the cyclist's damage incurred from the accident, and 100% if the cyclist was not at fault. However, if the cyclist intentionally rode into a car and then the blame falls to the cyclist, they must pay the damages. If in city centers, cars are often required to yield to cyclists, and Dutch drivers are taught to always expect a cyclist. Number nine, the Dutch are pretty tough. Boy, they are. They definitely are. The weather in the Netherlands can be erratic, cold, rainy, sunny, gray, or snowing, all in one day. Yet no matter what the temperature is, the Dutch are out and about on their bicycles and going about their days as usual. And this writer often shudders at the rainy gray days while the Dutch smile and cycle their way through them. A lot of noise is made in the Netherlands in cycling, whether you're here for a short or long time. This author would encourage you to embrace the Dutch cycling culture. Not only is it great fun, but it's also a fast track to gain a greater understanding of Dutch culture. If you have any questions, then you can obviously go to their digital and culture center and learn more about that. So, yeah, and this also goes along with the Dutch are some of the happiest people in the world. I mention this because I have mentioned it in the past, too. What is unusual about the Dutch versus other places, let's say the United States, where we are not the happiest people in the world at all. And the difference is that they ride bicycles. A lot of them ride bicycles. And because they're physically active and they're always moving and they're taking care of themselves and their health, and they don't have the stress of dealing with an automobile, which can be stressful in so many ways, repairs, maintenance, cost, insurance, all those things that create more stress in your life. And you know, if you ditch the car and get a bike instead, you can really ease up on your own personal stress. So that's why the Dutch are some of the happiest people in the world. So anyway, it's all related to around money and healthcare, I believe. So anyway, I thought that would be kind of a fun thing to talk about today. I have a strong appreciation for these folks because they really do. They really do. It's impressive. I've never been there, but I've seen videos. I've talked to friends who've gone there, and they say it's just amazing. Just there are bicycles everywhere. It's less cars, more bikes. Pretty cool. 70% of the population rides bike there. So, and they don't just do it for recreation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which we over here in the United States, we tend to be more of a recreation cycling type group. But okay, I'm going to move on to the beating the dead horse time. And the beating the dead horse thing comes back to reducing speeds is the answer. I remember, you know, I talked about this a few weeks ago, but yet more and more information keeps getting sent to me. Oh, did you see this article? Did you check this out, Ron? You know, I get a lot of listener feedback, so it's kind of cool. So this actually came from, I believe, People for Bikes. People for Bikes, great site, by the way. I actually have downloaded their, they have a 2023 study they did, many pages, and you can download the PDF file, and it's very interesting. There's lots of great information in there. I highly recommend it. peopleforbikes.org is where you want to go for this, but in the process of this, we'll get to that part in a bit, the Great Bike Infrastructure Project Supplemental Guide for Reducing Traffic Speeds. Yeah. So here it is. It's all down to the speed, and this is where the real problem is. Reducing the speed of vehicles is one of the most effective ways to make streets safer for everyone. When actual speeds are 20 to 25 miles per hour, crashes and fatalities decrease, and shared streets become safe and welcoming places for people to walk and bike. This is why communities worldwide have changed speed limits and street designs to lower vehicle speeds to 20 miles per hour. I've said it once, I'll say it again. If I were king, wherever there was a crosswalk that was painted across a road, the speed limit would be no more than 20 miles per hour and enforced. I talked about the city of Providence, and they have these great speed humps that they're using now to really reduce the speed down. It's made a huge difference in their injury and fatality rate, and basically fatality goes down to next to nothing, because even if you hit someone at 20 miles per hour and they fall down and hit their head, they're still probably going to survive from that. And anyway, we'll move on to this in a second. The Great Bike Infrastructure Project includes links to some of the best examples of policy changes communities have made to reduce speeds. People for Bikes have something called the Legislative Strategies Guide, and it will help you if you're trying to present this to your local community, if you're trying to do this. Why reduce speeds? Lowering speed limits reduces speeding. A study of New York City's neighborhood slow zones where speed limits were lowered from 25 miles per hour to 20 miles per hour showed that vehicle speeds decreased by 10 to 15%. In addition to the results from Seattle, two newer studies in Portland and Boston shed light on the effectiveness of lowering speed limits, refuting older studies that failed to show changes in driver behavior. Furthermore, while the newer studies showed limited reductions in the overall average speed of drivers, they noted dramatic decreases in the highest speeds. The odds of a driver speeding more than 10 miles per hour over the speed limit dropped by 29% in Boston and 50% in Portland. It's the speed, dummy. Lower speeds save lives and reduce life-changing serious injuries for all road users. Yes, and that includes people who drive cars and trucks. Okay, so these are very, very important things. Speeding is a significant cause of crashes. Speeding was a factor in 29% of all traffic fatalities in 2021, killing more than 33 people a day. At slower speeds, crashes are less frequent and less deadly. Traveling at slower speeds gives drivers a broader field of vision to see other cars, people walking and biking, as well as more time to react and brake. Crash fatality increases exponentially with speed. A person hit by a vehicle traveling at 35 miles per hour is 5 times more likely to die than a person hit by a vehicle traveling at 20 miles per hour. After lowering speed limits in downtown Seattle from 30 miles per hour to 25 miles per hour on arterial roads and from 25 to 20 on smaller streets in 2016, a recent study showed 20% reduction in the odds of injury, among other results. The study of New York's neighborhood slow zones showed that injuries to drivers and passengers dropped by 31%, and all injuries dropped down by 14%. Ah, boy. So lowering speed limit also benefits the economy. Speeding and related crashes are expensive, even for people not involved in crashes. The direct and indirect cost of traffic violence in the U.S. in 2019 was $340 billion. Roughly 3/4 of these costs are endured by those not directly involved in crashes through insurance premiums, taxes, as well as fuel, time, environmental costs related to the resulting congestion. Speeding-related crashes accounted for $46 billion, or 14% of those total costs. This means that the average of $141 for every person in the United States is spent on crashes resulting from speeding annually. Sure. You know, if this continues to go up, what happens? You know, your insurance goes up. If your insurance goes up, you end up paying more. You end up paying more even though you're not involved in it. It's just a matter of it's a big pool, and that's the way this works. So speed-related crashes cost lives and contribute to productivity loss. Road crashes are the leading cause of on-the-job deaths in the United States, accounting for 36% of those deaths in 2015. Millions more are injured on U.S. roadways, while the human cost of these deaths and injuries is incalculable. In 2019, these crashes caused an estimated $106 billion in workplace and household productivity costs. If you can't work because you got hit by a car, then you know, it costs money, costs lots of money. Slower speed limits don't negatively impact businesses. Studies found that streets that have more inviting, that are more inviting for people walking and biking are more vibrant and economically successful than streets with high volumes of fast-moving traffic. Duh. Yeah, that's a big DUH, as we like to call it here on Bicycle Talk. Lowering speed limits does not increase travel times for people driving. In a July of 2023 study by AAA, observed 12 highways over several years and concluded that lowering the posted speed limit by 5 miles per hour decreases crash frequency while having little to no effect on travel times. When was the last time you sat in traffic because there was an accident up the road? That's pretty obvious. Injuries from speeding reinforce existing socioeconomic disparities. Low-income residents are most likely to live on streets with fast-moving traffic and more likely to walk, bike, and wait for public transit, putting them in a disproportionately risky situation with speeding vehicles. So how do you reduce speeds? We talk about this a lot. Traffic calming is a big deal, and it's not a difficult thing to do. I talked about the speed humps last week. There was a great reference to those. I think I posted it on the Facebook Bicycle Talk page. Hopefully I did. But if you cannot find that information, please send me an email, and I'll point you to these relatively inexpensive speed humps that can be purchased. They're made out of rubber, and they are literally bolted down onto the pavement. And they're wonderful because they don't cost a lot of money, and they solve a big problem and drop speeds down to 20 miles per hour. So pretty cool. If you are in New England and you happen to be driving through Providence and you're on South Main Street in Providence, you'll be able to actually see how they work, because they work great. They work really, really good. And traffic still moves. The key point here is traffic still moves. It just moves at a slower rate, which is safer for everyone. So anyway, you don't need to be speeding all the time. So the best way to take action is to contact your state legislator and request that the state allow city to lower speed limits if it isn't already allowed in your state. Reference our legislative guide for how the examples of leading states have changed these laws. You can check with their references are with Washington and Oregon and California and Colorado and Minnesota and others. So you'll see that places like Nashville, Tennessee lowered its default speed from 30 miles an hour to 25 miles an hour in 2021. Tacoma, Washington did the same in 2021 for specific arterial speeds and went for non-arterial streets to a default speed of 20 miles per hour. Eugene, Oregon reduced most default speeds to 20 miles per hour in 2020, and Denver, Colorado was doing the same thing a year later. San Francisco reduced the speed to 20 miles per hour on 17 corridors, including busy commercial districts and some entire neighborhoods. So it can be done. It just needs to be done. That's all. Redesign the roads for lower speeds, which means you're putting traffic islands in, you're putting bump outs for sidewalks, for crosswalks, so that they appear to narrow the street. If you make the street look narrower, the cars will automatically slow down. If you make the streets look wider, the cars will automatically speed up. There are solutions, very simple solutions to these problems. And, you know, the bigger the vehicles get, the more we have to pay attention to this. I just heard a piece on the radio the other day about studies that are being done about these gigantic trucks that we're driving in this country, and that it's becoming like a huge concern because of the medical injuries that are occurring because of this. And who's paying really, really close attention to this? The insurance industry, because it's costing them a lot of money. It's costing them a whole lot of money. When it costs them a lot of money, it costs you a lot of money. And that's never good. That's never, ever good. So the idea here is that it's time to put a cap on the behemoth and start making them smaller. I saw some Chevrolet or Buick vehicle the other day in a parking lot, and it was big and it was black and it looked like a hearse. It was a passenger vehicle. But it was enormous, absolutely enormous. Took up a whole bunch of space. It actually took up more space than a normal car would in a parking space in the parking lot. More. Because it was longer, it was wide, barely fit between the lines. I don't get it. I don't understand. It makes no sense to me whatsoever. I don't know what America's obsession is with large vehicles. But I don't like it. Now, I don't like it because I ride a bike, and I want my safe space on the road too. And it's getting a little bit more difficult to do that. But anyway, time to rethink the size of the vehicle that we had the obsession with. You know, we went through this back in the 70s. Back in the 60s and 70s, we had these ginormous cars, and you know, they were the big Cadillacs with the big wings on the back, and they're just like these massive V8 engine monster cars. And then all of a sudden, what happened? The price of gas went up, and it became a lot more expensive to drive something like that. And then smaller cars started getting imported into the country. A lot of them were coming from Japan, Toyota and Nissan, Nippon Motors, whatever they call themselves. They were bringing in a lot of these vehicles, and the cars were much, much smaller, and they were much more fuel efficient. And then cars started getting a little more compact, a little slower, as we started making making rules that basically dictated how much gas you were able to burn, and you know, EPA standards changed, and so we had that emissions thing going on, and all of a sudden the cars got smaller and smaller, and we were on a roll. We were starting to bring in more cars from Europe, which already are small. They made sense. They were well thought out, and then now we're back to these gigantic monster trucks again, or whatever you want to call them, truck UVs. I don't know what you want to call it, but they're all trucks. They're all huge, and they're tall, and they're dangerous, and they're only dangerous to the people outside more so than the people inside the vehicle. So it's kind of a terrible thing. But anyway, you can go to People for Bikes, and you can check and see what they have to tell you about safe speeds, protected bike lanes, reallocated space, intersection treatments, network connections, trusted data, blah, blah, blah. So there's something called the Sprint Framework, which is safe roads, safe speeds, protected bike lanes, relocated space, all the things I just talked about. And it has lots of resources that you can go to. So if you need resources because you're going to go to a town meeting, you want to make a presentation there, and you want to talk about this a little bit more, there's a lot of ways you can get this information and bring it in. And it's all documented. It's not like you're making anything up here. It's real news. It's fact-checkable. It's good. And you're just going to see that there are so many improvements that can be made. And again, you know, I mention this all the time. If there is a 20 mile per hour speed limit where there are crosswalks, life would be better. It would be a whole lot better. It would make a lot more sense. And yeah, drivers will get impatient at first, and it'll take a while for them to adjust to it. But it can happen, and then when we ride our bikes, we'll be in a lot better place. And you'll actually probably feel better about riding your bike where there's more traffic, because the traffic will at least be slow, or slow enough that maybe even your traffic at that point, and you become part of it. You get in a flat situation, and you could very easily maintain the same speed as an automobile can. So anyway, there are lots of things you can do, and there's just tons of information out there. And you get lessons from the best biking cities like Austin, Texas, and Berkeley, California, Copenhagen, Montreal, all places all over the world, New Orleans, New York City, which is making a huge amount of changes with their infrastructure. And of course, Provincetown, which was, I think, named the best city in the U.S., safest city in the U.S. to ride a bike. They just got a big bonus star from People for Bikes. They've got a population of 3,000 people, and they scored some of the highest ratings from People for Bikes as far as bike safety went. Pretty cool. It's kind of a vacation town. Correction, it probably would be more considered a vacation town. So it may only have 3,000 people living there, but a lot of people come in during the summer months because it's on the beach and it's on the end of the Cape, and it's just a festive, fun, and interesting place. If you've ever been to Provincetown, you know what I'm talking about. But there's just lots of information out there. And once again, I go back to peopleforbikes.org. Check them out. That's it. I'm going to move on, and we're going to talk about some Vuelta España. Oh, yeah, that's another thing I had here, but we're not going to go there. So let's talk a little bit more about this. Enric Mas. It was fabulous. If you get a chance, go on YouTube and you can actually, you know, Google it. I guess that's what we call it now, Google it. And just type into the information part and look up Enric Mas, Enric Mas. He rides from Movistar. And he had become within a whisker of a major crash as a headwind caught his bike and the Spanish GC contender all but skidded off course. And it was really heart-stopping. I watched and I went, oh my God, he's done. And he wasn't, just like that. So but it's bike handling. It's just amazing. He was able to regain his composure, and I was truly impressed. People that can ride their bikes like that definitely deserve a major tip of the cycling cap on that one. That was pretty cool. So there's a lot of things going on right now in the Vuelta a España, and this is like I just the last year the defending champion this year is Sepp Kuss. Sepp Kuss did what I now call the Sepp Kuss syndrome or the Sepp Kuss phenomenon, which is he went off with a break. It was strategically done because he was working for the other riders on the Visma team, and they just wanted to send him out. And they do this often. They'll send one of their domestiques out on a break, and then when things get tight and tough at the end, the domestique will then drift back. And when they drift back, to help their GC leader or contender, but they're in the perfect position to do it because they don't have to chase down to get them. They settle back in, they rest their legs a little bit, and then they got fresh legs when the GC rider gets to them, and they can aid them towards the end. So they had sent him out to do that. This is a very, very common practice. They'd sent him out to do this, and the break got away, and it kept going, and it kept gaining speed and gaining distance. And pretty soon, Race Radio said, hey, you know what? This one's yours. Take it if you can. And they let him go. And so he's out there, and he goes on to put so much time on everyone else that the rest of his team had to work for him for the rest of the race, and he won the Vuelta last year. Fairly outstanding and unusual thing. But guess what? This year, the syndrome goes on, and there's an Australian, Ben O'Connor, and Ben O'Connor did the same thing. He just took off, solo shot. He went with a break, and then it became all by himself, and he's out there. And he's gaining 3 minutes, he's gaining 4 minutes, he's gaining 5 minutes. No one's really paying attention because he doesn't really have a big team he's riding for. He will be next year. There's already a change in place. But he's just out there riding and gaining distance. And the next thing you know, this was, I think, stage 6 is what it was. And next thing you know, he's got so much distance that he's got the winner's jersey. There's no question about it. Not only did he have the winner's jersey, he's got it by many minutes. So again, I call it the Sepp Kuss syndrome because it's exactly what Sepp did last year. So it's like almost like a playbook here. You know, if you've got someone who is that strong, who can do that and then be able to maintain them, you know, we don't know how long he's going to stay out there. He lost a little bit of time the other day, and then he maintained the time yesterday. So you really never know. So who else did this? Adam Yates. He did it yesterday. And Richard Carapaz. And they're back in the mix. And Adam did an amazing solo breakaway all by himself, worked himself to death. He said it's the hardest thing he's ever done. And he was fighting with cramping of the legs and the whole thing at the very end. And he stayed out and moved himself up in the GC by doing that. And just completely unexpected. And so anyway, the Vuelta has been a really crazy thing. And I'll read this. This is from a cycling up to date site. After an absolute thriller of a day and at the 2024 Vuelta España on stage 9, the general classification is completely shaken up once again. With all said and done, however, Ben O'Connor has actually extended his lead after taking 4 bonus seconds at the line. The star of the stage, though, was Adam Yates. On the day UAE Team Emirates lost Joao Almeida through COVID, the Brit took a scintillating stage win with a 58-kilometer solo that put him back just under 4 minutes on O'Connor's red jersey. Second on the day was Richard Carapaz, also making big moves in the GC with his attack, finishing a sandwich between Yates and the GC, moving up to third overall. It's just crazy stuff. Primoz Roglic wasn't at his best that day, although he has been riding really, really strong. Seemingly, he was suffering on the final climb, but nevertheless, the Slovenian retained second overall. Enric Mas was brilliant and attacking on the climbs, but after a sketchy moment on the descent, the Movistar team leader saw his hard work undone, eventually crossed the line alongside Roglic and O'Connor. Yeah, if he had not had that little skid out and that little mishap on the descent, he'd be in third place, not fourth place right now. So also in that group, you know, big known names, Mikel Landa, he was fifth overall. Florian Lipowitz is sixth. Felix Gall is eighth. And Carlos Rodriguez, 9. Dave Gadeau, who completes the top 10. So the Vuelta is exciting. It's interesting. It's really, again, you've got to watch the video where Enric Mas like did that crazy, crazy bike move. I'm just so impressed that he only lost like 15 or 20 seconds off of that. That's pretty impressive in itself. So Ben O'Connor is still 3 minutes and 53 seconds ahead of Primoz Roglic. Primoz Roglic was going to be, he was basically, everyone was saying it's going to be Primoz's race and he's probably going to win it. And unfortunately, you know, our U.S. rider is he's back a ways. So he's got, you know, because the top 10 riders, when we go to the top 10 rider, you're looking at, 6.5 minutes back off of the red jersey, the leader's jersey. Sepp Kuss is sitting at 8:16 behind. And next week, we're going to get into it. Today is a rest day. Next week, we'll get into, or this week, I should say, we'll get into some more mountains. The heat has been ridiculous. It's been 100 degrees almost every day. I don't know how you do that. I saw this. So why I love bike racing. Two riders are in a breakaway on opposing teams, but they're in a break and they're working together and they got it going on and it's 100 degrees out and one of the riders takes his water bottle, his spare water bottle, and dumps it on the head of the other rider. Not his teammate, no, his working companion, we'll call it. This is why bike racing is so different than so many other sports. You know, it's like, this guy realizes that the guy who's with him is overheating and really could use some help, and realizes also that they're just not going to be able to stay away and they're not going to be able to work together if this guy falls apart. So he helps him by dumping cold water on top of his head. It's bike racing, folks. It's a different sport. It's a different sport, different rules. The camaraderie is phenomenal. It really is. And it's, you know, we shall see. We shall see what's going on. But I'm looking forward to next week. There will be some good Vuelta activity coming up. I think I have a site here for that. And here we go. So we're probably going to be looking at a lot more. We're going to be looking at a lot more hills and big mountains, big mountains. Some of these Vuelta climbs are just almost obscene. They are, you know, 20%, sometimes more than 20% in the grades. Just crazy, crazy stuff. And I'm amazed that they can actually do this sometimes. So we're coming up on, let's see, we've done stage 9 right now. So we can look and see what's going on here next, if I can get my computer to work properly. Here we go. So we've got a lot of tough stages coming up here. That's stage 8. Rest. That's, see, I'm not pulling it all up, but somehow the breakdown is weird. But anyway, there's lots and lots of mountains in the Vuelta. The Vuelta is kind of famous for it. They've been known for having one of the more difficult races as far as that goes, and here we go, stage 10, here it comes. Let's see if they've got, it's a mountain stage, it's 160 kilometers, they call it medium mountains. No, that one is mountain, stage 11 is medium mountains. So we'll see. I'm looking at the profile right now. It starts with a monster. Looks like a beyond category. No, it's category 2. So it's definitely pretty big. But and then after that, there's a category 3, a category 2, and then a category 1 to finish with a major, major downhill. And, you know, those can be exciting, and they can also turn into game-changing ending to a rider's performance because of crashes and all. So hopefully nobody crashes. That's what we're hoping for. We never like to see people crash. I know some people watch bike racing to see the crashes, but that's not really very nice. Stage 11, which will be on Wednesday, is going to be just kind of a roller coaster more than anything else. Two category 3s, two category 2s. Looks like it'll probably be a fairly fast stage as far as that goes. That's my guess at least. Stage 12 is hilly, deemed as hilly, and has a mountaintop finish. So it will have an uphill finish on that one. And it's just, there's these races are just crazy. Stage 13 is 176 kilometers in the mountains, and again a mountaintop finish. Stage 14 is 200.5 kilometers, and again looks like major mountain climb at the end, Cat 1 climb with a very short downhill afterwards. And it's 200 kilometers, so it's long. And you got to remember, folks, these temperatures are ridiculous. 100 degrees Fahrenheit. 100 degrees Fahrenheit. That's really, really hot. It's really hard to stay hydrated and cool. I'm going to move on from the Vuelta and finish up the show here. I've got some events coming up I want to talk about, so we'll get there next. And we can get ourselves back on track. Where did I put it? This is an exciting time. I love bike racing, and I love talking about it and sharing what I know of it with you. It's one of the best sports out there as far as I'm concerned. And I even shared the video of Enric Mas's recovery with a friend of mine who's a big college basketball fan. We were up at the gym this morning talking about it, and he saw that and he went, "Oh my God, that's insane!" And I said, "Yeah," and he was probably doing 40 miles an hour when he did that too. So it is nuts. Anyway, the Vuelta España continues. It ends on the 8th of September. which is the same day as the Mansfield Hollow Cyclocross race. But in the meantime, CCAP Rocky Hill Training Series, Wednesday nights, August 28th, this Wednesday night, September 4th, 18th, and 25th. If you're looking to try out cross, you want to see what it's all about, it's a great opportunity. Great opportunity to learn more about cyclocross and to be able to get out there and ride with others that are training, getting in shape for, or converting themselves over from their road season to their cyclocross season. So it's a lot of fun. I think the races start around 5 or 6 o'clock on Wednesday evenings, and it's low key. It's not like super, you know, intense there, but it definitely is a challenging course and it's a lot of fun. Bringing me to Project Mayhem Cyclocross Series coming this fall. Yeah, well, the first one is going to be on the 8th of September. It is the Mansfield Hollow Cyclocross race, which has been going on for 41 years now. And we are now calling, because it's part of Project Mayhem, it is Damned at the Dam. Mansfield Hollow Dam is right there, so that's why it's that way. It's one of New England's classic races, one of the longest running cyclocross races in New England. So come down and check it out. I have secured a food truck, which will be serving Mexican food. We're going to have free coffee and free hot chocolate this year, too. Compliments of Click Kitchen, who we are helping out in the process of that too. So it's going to be a great regional cyclocross series, and there are seven different races in the series. After my race is September 14th in Haddam Neck, September 22nd in New Haven, October 6th in Newtown, October 20th in Portland, November 17th in Wallingford, and December 1st in Guilford, Connecticut. So lots of great cyclocross racing. I just got a notification from Tour Apacum, and they reached out to me to see if I would be willing to let cycling friends know about their event, which is coming up. And you can find tourapacum.org on the Bike Reg registration page. You can get to it there. So check it out. It's a cool bicycle tour, and it will be Sunday, September 15th. And Lime Rock Park Epic, which is a gravel ride coming up, based on the same gravel rides that were done here in the spring over here in northeastern Connecticut. This is done by Domestique Sports, and we're looking forward to that. That's Sunday, October 8th. So, finishing points. What do you think? It's, it's kind of an interesting Vuelta this year. I think there's a lot more coming. I think we're not done yet. I think that there's going to be a lead jersey change coming up this week, is my guess. I don't think any more of this solo breakaway stuff is going to be allowed, because it just seems like every time they do it, it changes the whole mechanics of the race. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But anyway, send me some comments. I'd love to hear about it. So 2024. You riding more miles? Are you riding to commute to work or around town? Are you riding for better fitness? Or are you simply enjoying the bicycle rides you're taking by slowing down and smelling the roses? That's my latest technique. I'll say it again. It won't be my last time. We need to get loud. We need to get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic, dangerous roads, the price of gas, and the lack of places to safely ride, and ride your bicycle instead. Ride your bike to work one day. Ride your bike around town one day. Park the car, truck. You just might surprise yourself. Give it a shot. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. You have been listening to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, lovely Dr. Fran Storch, who's not here at the moment. But anyway, you can listen to past episodes on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, or the Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. This is Pedal and Ron. Remember, keep that rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and whus.org. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week. Get it!